What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Pinnacle Performance Podcast. Today, I have Joel Reinhardt on. He is the Assistant Director of Sports Performance at UMass. And I posted an Instagram Q&A, a couple weeks ago, and I was like, who should I have on here? And someone mentioned Joel's name. I was like, oh, that's a really good idea. Because Joel has, Joel's really smart when it comes to a lot of things regarding speed and sports performance. I've been following him for a while, and I love his perspective. So Joel, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So could you just give people a brief overview background about you for those who might not be familiar?
Yeah, currently assistant director at UMass, like you mentioned. Work with football and women's lacrosse. Originally, I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, right outside St. Paul. I went to college at St. Olaf College. It's a small little D3 school outside the Twin Cities, played football there. And then right from there, I went to Springfield College. I did my master's in strength and conditioning there and GA'd. And then had, various internships along the way during that process. And then right after Springfield, I went to Louisiana. I worked at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux, Louisiana. I worked with, assisted with football, and then had a couple other sports that I took the lead on. And I was there for a year and a half before I got to UMass in January of 19. So I've been here for a year and some change. And
considering you're still relatively young, such as myself, I think it's pretty remarkable, your knowledge base and the way you think about things. Cause I've gotten a pretty good feel for like, at least kind of how your logical process to things. And I really like it. So what would you say have been some like foundational things along your path? Like some of the maybe people or books or experiences that you had that really like shaped your thought process?
Mm-hmm. I'd say the biggest thing that helped me from a coaching perspective in terms of, pumping the ideas and tactics and models that I wanted to use. Getting to Nicholls definitely helped that out a ton. When I got there, I was 23, 24, something like that. And I was straight out of my master's and knew that was kind of the moment when it was, you realize what you don't know. You realize how much you don't know. That click was like second year of my master's and then into my first year at Nicholls. And so I, knew my kind of ultimate career goals and basically asked myself, if I were offered one of those jobs, say I was offered some big time head of something job today, I would be unqualified for it. Why am I unqualified for it? Like, what are the gaps, essentially? And then identified those areas and just took deep dives on each of those areas until I felt comfortable. And I'm still, still.
What do you think they
process.
Were for you?
Formal education was incredibly weight room heavy for me. Very weight room heavy. So I definitely leaned towards I need to be able to impact, how can I impact on-field performance more, essentially? This is a whole nother,
I love it.
deep hole, but it's like, there's definitely there's the trend in strength and conditioning, still kind of going on, almost like moving towards like the medical model where you're being overseen by, ATs or doctors versus being overseen by a sport coach. And I just kind of fundamentally disagree with that, I guess, because it's almost, I look at it as I want to be as close to the sport coaches as possible and working in tandem as much as possible versus, being almost separated. And not that that means they need to be deciding to hire and firing necessarily, but it's like, you want to, ideally everybody knows everything about the sport and is able to do anything. Like, ideally your sports performance coach could step in and be whatever, could coach the receivers for a day. And ideally your receivers coach could watch a sprint session and know what's going on. You know, like that's, oh, you want to get it as integrated as possible.
Home. Yeah.
And so that was one thing where I was like, okay, how do I get to that? And I mean, reading Governing Dynamics of Coaching was huge. I love that book.
I still haven't read that book yet. I really want to.
It's that, and then reread that. And even like I was debating on whether or not I was going to pull the trigger and get it because it was like $100 or whatever. And I was poor, young strength.
Yeah, man. No, yeah.
But I saw Mark Uyama at a talk. He's the Vikings head strength coach. I saw him at a talk in Nashville in March of 18, something like that. And it was like, okay. And he's good friends with James Smith. And so he was talked about the book and I was like, all right, let's do this. So that was a very impactful. And then I guess practically at Nichols, I didn't worry about what my current like title or responsibilities were. I kept worrying about, okay, what is the gap between what I know now and what is absolutely knowable and how do I get there essentially? And so, you know, when I first got to Nichols, I got there right at the start of the season. So we just kind of hopped in in-season training and it was just kind of like craziness. I got there like 24 hours before our first game. I was like meeting dudes on the sideline during our first game. You know, I was like holding guys back and they're like, who's this guy? But it was an interesting time to like start, yeah. But it meant, you know, as we rolled through that season, then we got into, you know, looking towards starting the off season. I didn't necessarily have any programming responsibility. I was just kind of helping out coaching. And then I was, you know, programming from other teams, but just throughout the winter, Greg Carasquillo is the director there. We were just kind of going over random stuff about some open field work and speed work and how we wanted to organize everything for the winter. And then, you know, and kudos to Greg for trusting me on this. He was just like, hey, do you want to take the lead on this? And so that kind of boosted me forward into the, you know, the spring and the summer leading up into the fall of 18 season. I basically got to plan everything outside of the weight room. And then in season, I took the lead on like the developmental crew in the weight room as well. But that helped a lot because it was like, I didn't worry about, okay, like I'm in charge of, you know, I'm fully in charge of soccer and softball and with football, it's just kind of whatever. It was like, what is my ultimate goal? And I'm going to keep working to get there. And then along the way, me and Greg had a bunch of conversations about things that we were poking around in our brains. And it, you know, it helped that I was with Greg as my boss because he's definitely somebody who was like, you know, the best ideas are going to get implemented, whether like no matter who they come from. And that's part of why he has a, you know, successful organization down there. And, you know, that's part of one of the reasons that I ended up wanting to, you know, work for Coach Shadid here at UMass is he's similar. Doesn't matter who the ideas come from, the best ideas are going to get implemented. And so that was huge as a young coach because I knew like, you know, if I'm striving to push my own knowledge base and not just theoretical knowledge base, but how can we apply it right now with our, you know, top 15 FCS football team at Nichols, it was, you know, it was going to get used. And it wasn't just like, oh, I'll put that in my notebook for 10 years from now. It was like, no, we'll do this on Tuesday if it's the best thing to do, you know, and fits within the overall scheme. So that was huge. And then, I don't know. I knew I was in the middle of nowhere in Louisiana, no disrespect to Nichols, but I was intentional about like starting conversations like that on social media, and that, you know, that helped me interact with some people who I might not have interacted with. And I put something up and some really smart person said, that's a good idea. And another really smart person said, this is garbage. And then you know, it starts a conversation, yeah. You know, and then you get to learn a lot from that, which was awesome. And yeah, so I'd say, sorry if I'm not actually answering your question.
No, you're good. You're good. It's good.
Yeah, it was, I always just tried to look at it as if I got, if somebody let me completely take over a program for my like dream of what that is tomorrow, which is essentially planning all the physical loads, including the physical load in practice, would I have the knowledge to do that successfully tomorrow? And if no, what's in my way? And then I just started checking off that list, and I'm still checking off that list until I'm there and can, you know, kind of step into that role, I guess, whenever that comes along, and then, you know, continue to even grow from there. So
given that this is a journey that ultimately never ends for anyone, we're all just still kind of like going about this and trying to, it's just like a, it's like the self-betterment journey. It never actually ends until the day you die. But I think that's important to have that every step of the way. So given that we're far from a completed product, like what's important to you today? Like what do you look for? What do you think are the big frogs? So to say, there's that saying, eat the big frog first. What are your big frogs?
That's good. I don't know. One thing I'm trying to get, both me and Shadid are trying to work at and have had some conversations already to implement better, is the kind of year-round, keeping the year-round stimulus of some sort of contact on our guys, so that, you know, the start of spring ball or the start of fall camp isn't the first introduction of like true contact that they're getting, and scaling that in such a way that we can, you know, implement it from like a ground zero type of way. We've had chats with Andy Ryland on that. I'm actually, as soon as we're done here, I'm talking with Mike Tucker, who's at Villanova, because he's already implemented it. Because we, you know, we understand the theoretical and like the how we would go about it in a best case scenario in terms of implementing it, but we're just getting some better examples from guys who have implemented.
That's an interesting idea. Like, what's your thought process behind that? Is just to keep that stimulus there all year, so they don't have to lose what it feels like.
Not necessarily all year. I mean, like having times where we're giving them some off, but you know, introducing whether it's the grappling or, you know, the ability to just interact with another human being physically is something that, you know, is a load in and of itself. So no matter how much, you know, no matter how many squats or sprints or throws or jumps or whatever we're doing all winter, if the first impact that these guys are getting is the first padded practice in spring ball, then that's a huge spike in, you know, contact load essentially. And so working, you know, finding ways to better implement that without, you know, because contact isn't necessarily something that you want to keep at, 100 all year round, because it is naturally very stressful on, you know, soft tissues. But, doing so in a, you know, implementing it in a way that, especially over the summer, when you get to fall camp, it's not, you know, all of a sudden you get hit 30 times in one day and you've gotten hit zero times over the last month.
What kind of contacts would these be? Would these be like predictable, probably safer hits of lesser impact? Would they be?
Yeah. Some of it's like, you know, grappling with other, you know, athletes, you know, and, you know, trying to hold your own shape while changing somebody else's shape, you know, and leverages. And, but then also some of it is just like interacting with the ground, like as simple as like,
that's huge,
tumbling and rolling and just getting used to, I'm, you know, standing up and then I'm on the ground. Like that's a skill in and of itself. And, you know, not to say you should take that and then justify your burpees with it, but
no.
But you know, just scaling the impact and the impulse of, you know, interacting with the ground and interacting with other human beings in a way that is very, very different than you know, just you know, typical sprints, jumps, throws, lifts, all that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I haven't heard many strength coaches talk about that. Like, that's a unique and interesting idea. So yeah. What else is big on your list?
I'm trying to improve how we're going about utilizing our catapult and our GPS, just so it's as actionable as possible. That's one of the things that I'm currently working on as we get closer to, you know, inevitably coming back from this hiatus, you know, whatever the return ends up looking like, whether it's 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. You know, this past year was our first year with the GPS. And so we were collecting a bunch of data and we were able to have, you know, make some action based off of it from like our
previous knowledge. What kinds of stuff are you looking at?
You know, like, hey, one of our slot receivers, his backup rolled his ankle 5 minutes into practice and his other backup got kicked off the team last week. And so all of a sudden you look at his yardages and he got 30% more yardage than any other receiver. And you go, oh, wow, like maybe we should check that out for tomorrow's practice, you know, things like that, where it was like very quick on the fly. But now that we have a full year of data, we're able to go back and say, okay, like I broke the games down per position by every metric we have basically per play, and then was able to extrapolate that out to a number of plays per game. And that was nice to do so that we can, you know, as we build out volumes and metrics in terms of, you know, getting ready for a season, that was going to help shape our summer when that was going to be normal, but that ended up changing. But even then, one step past that, I have all our practices tagged per period. And so that's what I'm doing now, is going through and getting every metric that we have split up by the different periods. Like, you know, a receiver is, for every 5 minutes of team, is getting this amount of average load, yardage, high speed distance, explosive efforts. And
that's really useful information.
Yeah. And then, you know, I was putting that up for every position, for every you know, period that we do, whether it's third down blitz or team or special teams or situational awareness, you know, like all these different periods that we have in practice, just going through and getting essentially everyone down to every metric per period. And then when we go through and make a practice plan, we'll be able to, you know, I'll have a drop down in the middle and we pull up the period that we want to hit, and it'll spit out the averages that we can expect to see for each of those periods. Obviously there's wiggle room and it's not going to be the end all be all, but it at least gives us a snapshot into what our guys will be incurring from each. And it'll also give us insight just from once I get done with the breakdown of like, what are the periods that we think are intense, actually intense, or are they not, or, you know, the periods that we think are actually kind of easy, are they actually super intense, you know, things like that.
Like energy system development too.
Yeah. And, or yeah, even more so like total load, like, and high speed distance is like the big one. Cause it's like, okay, if we're trying to limit or get high speed distance on certain days, are there, you know, and we think this drill will give us a ton of high speed distance. Does it actually, essentially? Yeah. And then it even allows you to just split up, even if you don't even change what you're doing in practice, it allows you to potentially split up things in a way that you can prioritize different qualities on different days. And, you know, even from the GPS standpoint, all of it is made easier for us because we like we essentially, Coach Shadid and I basically are given the green light to, you know, we kind of plan the physical aspect of practice, which is nice, you know, to a certain extent. And like our camp schedule of, you know, these many days on, these many days off, we're going to go build up in volume, come back down a little bit. You know, our head coach is leaning on us for that. And then even within a game week, you know, we go Sundays are kind of a flush out. Mondays are off. Tuesdays are a, you know, kind of a heavy hitter practice, but it's more on the force side of the spectrum. Lower speed, higher force, a lot more collision. Wednesday is a little more higher speed, lower force, less collision, more open spaces. Thursday is a true walkthrough. And then Friday is very short volume, almost like a potentiation. We call it Fast Friday. And then we go play on Saturdays. Mm. And so that model, we were, you know, that was from our head coach basically saying, how should we practice? You know, and we're not getting in there saying you need to work on 3rd and 10 on Tuesdays. But, shaping it in such a way that we're putting our guys in the best possible physical spot to play on Saturdays, you know, while not getting in the way of all the technical and tactical that needs to get done throughout a week.
Well, that's cool that your head coach literally asks, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's not the most common thing in the world. Like most, correct. There's a lot of head coaches out there that just kind of like do it. But like, the fact that they sought out input from you, that speaks a lot to your relationship.
Yeah. And that's, it helps out a ton, and it makes all the nitty gritty, like inputting data of the catapult worthwhile. I don't know. It's mm-hmm. like I touched on earlier. Like if you know what you're going to do is actually being used, then it makes it more worthwhile versus like, oh, I made this beautiful catapult dashboard and right. nobody gives a shit. Like,
yeah,
which is 95%. Like I've had, when I did a little video like February or something like that of kind of that initial breakdown I did of our catapult, and I had some people reach out, and I even talked to some people about, you know, and I even talked this week with some people about, hey, how can we kind of work to get that same sort of dashboard and breakdown? And then it's like, I always stop. It's like, does your head coach actually care and make change off of this data? If no, like, we can stop talking. Like,
yeah.
It's not like, go, you know, spend the time that you would be doing this trying to convince him to help you out, like, and let you take some action, like putting the cart before the horse a little bit. But knowing that it's actually being used, it gives us more, it makes it much, you know, more meaningful and enjoyable when it's, hey, you know, we've got, we got this cool new dashboard or whatever, like, we're going to go through the planning and all that. So yeah, definitely. It definitely helps having a head ball coach on board. And that's, you know, part of the reason why this job was attractive to me, because I knew Shadid, and Shadid spoke very highly of Coach Bell and how he was knew the importance of, you know, us in, you know, the physical aspect of our team. Not just for the, you know, 8 weeks of the winter and the 8 weeks of the summer, but, you know, year round. So.
Yeah. Kind of switching gears, I wanted to ask you about a post you made that I thought was very insightful. It was about game speed. And I'll just read a couple of things from there that I thought were really good. You took this gentleman whose name I will absolutely not be able to pronounce.
Kylian Mbappe.
Him. You took him and you broke down essentially when he's running with the ball and without the ball, it's really not that different. You basically said that, here, let me read the quote so I don't misquote you. He seamlessly shifts his run strides according to the constraints presented to him. During the stride before and after the stride, and the stride after contacting the ball, he gets right back into pretty-looking shapes. Even on the stride where he contacts the ball, he falls into better shapes than most do without the ball. And ultimately, this comes down to his trained and inherent ability to, A, sprint really, really well, and B, to also, what was the other thing you said? I don't want to get this wrong. Unconsciously be able to grasp the attractors that shape us into efficient sprinting in order to have them hold in a chaotic competitive environment. I think that's the key words right there. That's implicit training. That's subconscious processing. Because if he's thinking about that in that moment, then he is going to basically be much higher likelihood of choking. He's like, man, do I put this foot first? Or how do I, what part of my foot do I hit this ball with? Then that's probably going to lead to him ultimately thinking too much and not focusing on the environment around him. Whereas you make the argument, he's doing this much more implicitly, which is why he's so elite.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of that post is obviously specifically with soccer. And I just was watching some Mbappe clips because he's, you know, arguably the fastest soccer player in the world, or definitely the fastest on the ball. And it was like, okay, what is making him so good with the ball? Because I mean, you see it in some of the clips. He's dribbling by guys who are, you know, free running.
And so it's fast.
And so there's two sides of the coin that I talked about. It's like you know, if your game speed's never going to be 20 miles an hour if your absolute max V is 19. So, you know, you still have to, the ceiling has to be there. You have to raise the absolute ceiling through, you know, just building the absolute qualities. And, you know, whether that's through just, you know, true sprint training or, you know, however you go about attacking that, whatever the quality is, specifically this, you know, speed. And so, you know, just like going after like true sprint training in a, you know, not necessarily representative environment. And then you have, you know, the other extreme, which is the expression of that in a game scenario while executing technical skills in a tactical environment. And so it was like, okay, how do you bridge that gap? And I feel like at least a lot of the arguments I'd heard were always on the technical tactical side of, you know, you have to be so good at your technical tactical skills that you can express them at top speed, which is 100% true. But the flip side of that is you have to be so good at sprinting also that you can do that while executing technical tactical skills. And when you look at sprinting as a skill, that leap becomes much easier because you're having to execute two skills at the same time. You have to be really good at both. Mm-hmm. Whether it's dribbling a basketball and sprinting, or, you know, cradling a lacrosse ball and sprinting, you know, whatever it may be. When you view them as two skills, then it's that leap becomes a lot easier to make. And, you know, I don't necessarily have the answer, like, of what's the best way to do it. But it's something that is something we should strive for. I don't know. I guess like in watching Mbappe, and then it's like Brandon Cooks is like this in the NFL. Randy Moss was like this. It's like, you're so good. You're so fluid sprinting wise and so good at the technical tactical that the difference between you just going out and running a fly 10 on a grass field with nobody around, the difference between those shapes and the shapes that you fall into in a game when, you know, aren't that different depending on the constraints. Because it's, you know, you think, okay, yes, if a defender is coming to hit me, I'm going to drop my center of mass. I'm not going to be as high hipped. But I think a lot of not as smooth athletes, they end up giving into those constraints either too early or stay into them after they don't need to be. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things with Mbappe. He could just, you know, dribble and pitter patter all the way down the field, but he's skillful enough that he can get a quick contact, get right back into pretty shapes for the constraint that is given to him, which at that point, it's the ball is whatever, 5-10 yards ahead of me, and I just need to get there as fast as possible. And so that constraint is just sprint as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And then when he gets closer, he, you know, his penultimate step and either, and then his contact step are slightly different because he's interacting with the ball. That's the constraint. And then it goes right back to, okay, now I just need to get there as fast as possible. And so if that time where it's, I need to get there as fast as possible still looks shitty, like you're not going to be fast. And a lot of, you know, like Brandon Cooks and Randy Moss both do this too. Like two of the clips that we've pulled and given to our guys, like, look at this. You know, whereas in a route, you know, he's running a route where he's having to interact and read a defense. So he's a little more low hipped, anticipating, changing direction. But then when he catches the ball, turns, shakes one dude, and it's green grass, the constraint is get to the end zone as fast as possible.
Get there before the other guy.
Yeah. And then they fall into, you know, this high hipped go time sprinting. And it's like, okay, that's what makes them, you know, and you watch the defenders who are, you know, not getting into as good of shapes or whatever. And it's like, and they're just blown by dudes. And it's like, that is what makes them great. Like, it's not, they have both. They have the ability to shape, you know, change their motor outcomes based on the constraints given to them. But it's important to recognize that oftentimes that constraint is there's open field in front of you. Get to something as fast as possible before somebody else gets there. And if you can't sprint well, you're not going to be good under that constraint. Mm-hmm. And that is, those are often the plays that, you know, win or lose games, whether it's soccer, lacrosse, football, whatever it may be. So it's important to, you know, work both ends of that spectrum, but then also find like that kind of in between meshing of those two so that it's not just, you know, you're still building the ceiling on both ends, but meshing them in the middle as well. I mean, even I just emailed back and forth with a rugby coach who I've never worked with rugby. I've never even seen a full rugby game.
Same.
But he's talking about, you know, when a rugby guy's holding the ball and two hands in front and anticipating a pass, anticipating that he is about to pass the ball, you have to dissociate up top from down below because, you know, I might be sprinting forward, but I'm looking to my left and my shoulders are going with me because I'm anticipating throwing the ball over there, you know, all those sorts of things. And it's like, how would you go about attacking that? And it was like, it was fun for me. It was like a little, you know, thought
experiment. Drill
almost. Yeah, yeah. Like, okay, let's, you know, thinking like three directions. Like, okay, you build the ceiling on both ends. Like, you got to be as fast as possible and have like, you know, unconscious shapes and attractors for your sprinting that, you know, you're not having to think like, I'm going to keep my ribs down and get my knees up. Like, that can't be it. And that will shape every single drill that you give or drill or cue that you give to your athletes to tweak their sprinting shapes in an, you know, in a completely non-contextual environment, you know, just a speed session. Like, having those shapes carry over should shape every single word that comes out of your mouth and drill that you implement. But then also, you know, the flip side is he has to be really good at understanding where his teammates are and being good at passing the ball. But then it's like, there's that middle ground of, this is where even I started just like brainstorming, like, you know, do you work on some sprinting without the ball where it's, you know, hands clasped in front and just, you know, not worrying about teammates, but it's just, I need to get from A to B as fast as possible, but I got my hands clasped in front, you know, kind of mimicking the ball, you know, something in the middle there that is bridging that gap, but not, you know, bridging the gap, but still not like getting in the way of sports skill, I guess, and but like, if you're going to implement you know, some sort of special development exercise, it better be useful enough that it's, you can justify using it instead of actually just playing the game.
Do you know who James Smith is?
I do. Yes. Oh, which one? I should say.
He's like the U of Strength.
Yes, I do. Yes.
I had him on the podcast. I think he would be a good guest for yours as well. Cause I think he's one of the best at this kind of thing. Cause I think like the theory of like skill acquisition, motor control, nonlinear pedagogy. I think these things are the theory I think people buy into. I think it makes sense to people. But the hard part is taking these concepts and applying them in a real life manner to where like you're actually getting the intended outcome, because there's so many different ways to skin this cat. But the more I think about it, and something I'm really kind of secretly passionate about, is that I think that that stuff is so undervalued for what like strength and conditioning coaches can be doing. Like that stuff, man, like just the ability to couple this force production when making good decisions or the right decision at the right time. That's a extremely powerful thing that I think we don't tap into quite as much as we maybe should in some cases, but also it's frankly very hard to make the right constraints at the right time. What do you do when you go about determining like a drill and making it, obviously like depends on the adaptation you're going for, but what do you think about when you're like, okay, I want to train this person's ability to switch from sprinting to sprinting with a ball, for example, or like, how are you going to break that down and create a drill that works in that context?
Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is like starting with the sport and analyzing the sport in such a way that you truly know what they're actually trying to get ready for.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next piece is, you know, coordinating with the sport coaches in such a way that they, you know, A, you're not just doubling up on stuff.
Yeah.
But B, you're not also, you know, missing what could be a valuable gap there. And I know maybe for a lot of sports, I actually avoid a lot of this because they're playing so much, and that's good. I mean, you want to be practicing your sport as much as possible. So providing, you know, I've been questioning like, I work with say I'm working with a soccer and they, it's like, okay, I want to provide some open agility environments to them. And I can provide these specific constraints. But then you're ignoring the fact that they have practice later this afternoon. It's like, that is their,
And there's so many constraints you can choose. You know, you can go in individual, task, environmental. Like, where do you even start with that?
Yeah, and I definitely think it's valuable, and we've even used it. I mean, we like at Nichols, we almost all of our stuff was open. But with football, that's, you know, you have a big gap in the year where you're not allowed to practice. So then we have to supplement some of that, you know, work. But even, you know, like here at UMass, we were like, okay, let's basically starting with, you know, above all else, the most important thing is that we need to practice our sport as much as possible, as healthy as possible.
Huge.
How do we support that and build that in such a way? Like, 'cause I know I've been around programs and, you know, seen and talked with other people where, you know, like all summer in college football, guys are playing 7-on-7. The old linemen and D linemen are doing individuals against each other, like by themselves, not with coaches. You know, that's when coaches are on, you know, position coaches are on vacation and whatnot. But the guys are still doing it. So you can either integrate it or not, but it's still happening. And that's one of the things we did last summer. Like, we, our player run practices where it's like, they're running it. We're not out there. Like, coaches are on vacation. Like, it's not even like a wink, wink type thing. Like, it's them, but we help them, like, okay, you're going to put them on these specific days at these specific times, so that they fit into the overarching model that we want to hit. And we can account for, you know, the movement patterns that are happening in those because we know the drills that they're going through, and then we don't have to double up on them. For like the opposite example is Okay, so you set up a nice high-low model of, you know, what is everything? Monday, Wednesday, Friday are your high days, and Tuesday, Thursday are low. And then your quarterbacks and receivers are going out and running 50 routes each on Tuesdays and Thursday nights because it fits into their class schedule. And high-low model just became five high days in a row. But it's like, oh, that's the guy's stuff. They're doing that on their own time. Well, it's like, it's happening. So either you can account for it or not. I mean, we're going to choose to account for it. So we don't actually provide a whole lot of, like, quote unquote, you know, representative environments like that in terms of our specific work. But we just supplement, like, hey, we're going to do our speed session. That's our, like, mandatory team training. And then as soon as that's done, that's when you guys can start your player practice. And then we'll all go inside and start working on whatever we need to work on. And you got your player practice, go. And, you know, and even outside of that, you know, maybe it's, okay, you're getting these movement patterns aren't being used as much in this practice, so we're going to supplement them here a little bit, something like that. But I think that's the biggest thing, is just like making sure that you do start with the sport and promote as much sport activity as possible, or smart sport activity as possible. That is, you know, getting the technical and tactical outcomes that you want, because you can, you know, even like providing good open environments is still very general if it's not practice. You know, it's not like, I'd rather have our guys, instead of being like, hey, we're going to do this one-on-one tag drill that's going to eat up probably a lot of energy. Like, hey, we're going to do our speed work, extended warm up, and then we're going to leave, and you guys are going to run one-on-ones, DBs and wide receivers, you know, like with all sorts of varied routes and, you know, one-on-ones, two-on-twos, like all that, you know, to get, you know, the desired outcomes that we were seeking from a, you know, non-linear standpoint of, you know, different movement patterns, but also doing it in such a way that we're promoting as much sport activity as possible and not just saying, oh, we worked on some great change of direction, you know, see you later. And then they go and run a million routes, and we actually, all we did was double up on the movement patterns and didn't actually provide that much. So just always making sure that we, you know, are promoting the sport first. And then if there are things that need to be overloaded that aren't being overloaded in the sport, then that's where we supplement.
Mm. Do you guys have a system of determining attractors and fluctuators?
For
let's say sprinting, for example.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, we have like the mechanical model that we're working towards, with, you know, different, certainly like pelvic positions, you know, different looking, it's hard to, I guess, describe. Maybe this is good practice for me.
There you go.
I can look at it and point it out, but, you know, a solid front side mechanics, you know, good interaction with the ground, you know, at, or, you know, slightly in front of center of mass at touchdown, you know, if you're upright, well, you know, where is an acceleration, you know, looking for a good power line, and then, you know, looking for foot strike at or slightly behind the hip, and, you know, and then if our guys are not falling into that, identifying very quickly what the issue is. And for our guys specifically, it and I've seen this in almost all team sports, is lack of control of the pelvis and lack of force production due to energy leaks at the ankle. And
generally speaking, how do you see that at the ankle?
Well, you can see it, like, if it's, you can see, I mean, on contact, just a whole bunch of mush and not
spending a lot of time on the ground.
Yeah, a lot of deformation of the ankle complex after touchdown. Or, you know, even if it's in, if it's when they're like fully upright, you can then see it as, you know, lack of vertical projection, potentially some guys where it gets doubled down where they have no control over their pelvis and no vertical projection. And so then they are all sorts of behind themselves. But even in like an acceleration, like, hey, well, you know, ability to handle those forces at the ankles, sometimes it means guys just pop right up. And it's not a matter of them like, oh, trying to stay low or anything like that. It's just like they can't handle those forces. And so their body figures it out by just getting them more upright. And then so we attack it. Those are the two biggest things that we notice is kind of, you know, pelvic positioning and then force production at the ankle. And attack it in such a way that we're building it such that the guys don't really have to think about it. And you know, force production of the ankle is kind of probably the easier of those two to work implicitly, because, you know, it's just like hammer them away with, you know, this winter specifically, it was a lot of foot isometrics, extensive plyometrics, pogos, working up too intensive, you know, just developing a better ability to interact with the ground essentially. And then from a pelvic standpoint, some of it was, I guess some of it is like understanding what we're actually looking for. And so we do like with some teaching of like, hey, you know, whether it's a video of themselves or videos of, you know, different NFL players that do it well. Like, this is what we're looking for, you know, showing it, showing themselves, showing a good example, showing a bad example,
I like that.
Those sorts of things. But then also, you know, being aware of not showing them a million things. And so they're just thinking about it the whole time. And so just providing environments where they have to get their, they have to control their pelvis or shit hits the fan. And, you know, we did some, you know, some constrained wickets, some PVC constrained wickets. But even within the wickets, making sure they're understanding what we're looking for, because wickets can get pretty ugly pretty fast and can even go the opposite way where you're just trying to reach. And all you're trying to do is pull your knees up, which isn't the issue. The issue is your pelvis. And so it's okay, we're not, don't even worry about your knees or like pulling your knees up. And that's one of the things, you know, we avoid is, you know, fixing postural problems with limb solutions. And because like we're all, you know, getting back to the game speed thing. If a kid goes from poor pelvic, you know, mechanics that is being seen more grossly as poor limb mechanics, and you fix the limb mechanics without fixing the pelvic mechanics, when you get in a chaotic environment where he's not thinking about it, it's going to go to shit.
Yeah. And
so you like figuring out why the pelvis isn't actually being controlled and attacking that, you know, very specifically. And you know, and then there might be some other guys who, you know, and some of us like our mid skill, like linebacker type dudes who they have the pelvic mechanics, they have the force production at the ankle, but they're just not supple enough to get into, you know, the requisite, they don't have the requisite joint mobility and flexibility to get into the shapes that we want to see. So then that's, you know, the other aspect of, okay, we need to attack that. So, but those cases are more rare, at least from a team sport perspective. But yeah, I mean, we all have, Coach Adid and I have that, you know, kind of Altus model of sprinting that we want to see in a controlled environment, and getting our guys there is awesome. And you know, we're gonna, doesn't matter how many Nordics we do, like if our guys are shitty at sprinting, like we're not bulletproofing their hamstrings, like it doesn't matter. So realizing what's actually going to impact on their performance and help them out from a health standpoint as well, so that we are, you know, doing, actually impacting, and not just, you know, saying, oh, we fixed this and this, when in reality we didn't. And that's why it's so important to, you know, not just look at, okay, you know, it's obviously, it's good to start with, okay, we have a mechanical model that we're working from, we need to get there, But then the path of how you get there is equally as important in ensuring that those skills then transfer over into a kinesiotic environment where the player isn't actively thinking about what they're doing. Because you can spend an 8-week summer leading up into camp and get everybody in picture perfect shapes. But if, you know, you don't, you know, if they're thinking about it the whole time, then those are, you know, it can maybe the first week or two, if a guy's like brand new, he's thinking, but you gotta shift away from that. And that should shape, you know, the environments that you give them and the cues that you give them in order to fix those things. And I guess some of that comes back to, you know, being able to truly identify what the limiter is.
Well said.
Like the example I gave of the low force production at the ankle, sometimes that gets exhibited as no front side mechanics or bad front side mechanics because, you know, that you're not getting up in front because there's no reaction off the ground because you're not actually applying any force. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to just be like, oh, just get your knees up. When in reality, it's like, no, that's not the problem. Like that's how it's showing itself, but that's not the actual problem.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know. I guess I've never really talked about this on a podcast. My friends are probably sick of hearing me talk about this. But like, it's like a third law of motion type thing. Like if you're, there are a lot of things that show themselves, like the things that actually make up like pretty sprinting, a lot of them are reactions. And then the things that actually get us there are the actions that usually actually need to be fixed. And so if you just hammer away on the reactions being messed up, then without fixing the underlying action, it's just going to cause frustration and then it's not going to carry over into a chaotic environment.
I love how you said
that one specifically where it's, you know, the reaction is lack of front side. You know, let's say the kid has decent pelvic mechanics and decent suppleness and he's just not getting any sort of good looking front side mechanics. And it's like, maybe he's it's because he's applying his mushy ankles and isn't actually putting any force into the ground and it's just leaking everywhere. You know, it's easy to be like, okay, just get your knees up, but that's the reaction to the action, which is striking the ground. So
yeah, that's really, I think that's a big thing that some people are missing when it comes to these mechanics, is that it's not the knees up cue that's going, that is a symptom of a potentially greater underlying problem. And that's there. We can watch a lot of these sprint seminars and videos off of YouTube of drills, but really a lot of these things come down to exactly what you just said. And a lot of the times just giving someone a drill or a cue is not enough to fix what is the outcome of the reason why we're giving that cue or drill. So I think that's really well said. How many of your freshmen do you feel like come in and don't have, like, you look at them and you're like, man, you need a ton of work on your sprint mechanics?
It's hard to give a number. It kind of depends. I mean, we've had some kids that come in and never run track their whole lives. And it's like, okay, we don't have to do anything. Just go run fast. And then that's just providing environments for them to run fast. But
I'm just curious because I'm curious, like, how, in your experience, how well prepared for athletics on the collegiate level do you feel like these athletes, generally speaking, are coming in from high school strength and conditioning, assuming they had that program at their high school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say, I mean, most, if they're being recruited to play at our level, they're usually pretty decent movers on the field.
You
know, where we see the biggest thing is weight room starting out. Just like lack of extreme strength and extreme range of motion is the big thing that we kind of press. Like, you know, you'll see it. You know, even if a kid is, say he's, you know, oh, coach, I'm a 300-pound squatter or whatever. And he might even be legit below parallel, but then it gets to us and we put his heels up on a wedge and we're like, okay, we'll put your ass on your heels for every single rep. And that's completely different, you know?
Yeah.
So it's usually the deficits in the weight room from a And I would say usually it's biased towards the ability for them to control their own bodies.
Mm.
Regardless, you know, outside of can you control a barbell or hang clean or whatever.
Yeah.
The ability to, you know, you'd be surprised at the number of, you know, whatever, I'm a 3-star D end and I can't actually do like a solid looking push up with like control my ribs and get my pelvis in a good position and, you know,
right,
all that sort of stuff. But
I know what you mean.
From an on-field standpoint, for the most part, they have a decent understanding. It's just not getting in their way. I would say, like, this comes back to, like, the like team speed is, like, a team-wide system. It can't be, like yeah, you whatever, you do your team your speed work on Mondays and Thursdays and your conditioning on Tuesdays and Fridays. But if that conditioning is just a bunch of sloppy, like, half gassers where there's no focus on mechanics or anything like that, like, then it's, you don't actually care about team speed, you know, it's just, you're just inserting some speed work. And you know, that's one of the things that our guys will would probably echo is like, no matter what the day of the week was, you know, our focus was on speed of movement. Even if it's in an environment like extensive tempo or, you know, extensive plyometrics, like the focus is always how can this help us move fast?
Mm-hmm.
In a, you know, because it is, you know, we play football. We're not in Australian rules football or whatever. And the endurance aspect of football is pretty easily trained once you get the underlying factors in place. It's, you know, like for our guys, it's whether it's in a speed session, obviously the focus is speed, but even like our extensive tempo days, like it's thinking about where your pelvis is, how are you going to act with the ground, because you know, the speed of movement is slowed down. So it's, you're able to think a little more and you're not worried so much about like, oh, I got to hit this time at this perfect time. Versus if it's just like, oh, we're going to throw out some, we're doing 10 half gassers today. Like, not even thinking about like, oh, that's lactate versus aerobic. Purely looking at it from a skill development standpoint, it's not an optimal environment to develop the skill that we're trying to develop. You know, and that's, you know, I'm pretty much talking just like non-lineman right now, I guess, because lineman is a little different beast. But it's... Yeah. It's making, ensuring that it's a team wide focus. It's not, it can't, like, it has to be a whole system, which I maybe can roll into the next thing you wanted to talk about, but, it's not, you can't just insert one thing and be like, oh, this is changing everything. 'Cause that's silly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, ultimately, yeah, there, it is. So like, as you kind of touched on, it's interdisciplinary in terms of like what strength and conditioning inherently is. There's so many things that are affecting. You made a post about this web, and it had all these different qualities on it, anywhere from speed to range of motion, to emotional control, to biomechanical efficiency, to sleep habits, all the way to cognitive abilities and just moral character. So those are all over the place, but they're there for a reason. It's not a random list of words. So in your mind, what is that web where everything is interconnected in some way, shape, or form? How does that represent your approach?
Yeah. And I even laughed at that. So when I made that little web on, I think I just did it in like Microsoft Word, I put all of those qualities in. I didn't really care about where they fell on the web. And so I was laughing because one of the webs ended up being speed tied directly to moral character.
That's great.
And I think Lance Walker commented on it, like, I didn't know speed affected your moral character. And I was like, oh, it's, I just kind of put those in randomly. Yeah. But the overarching sentiment still holds true. But it's basically like, I don't know, in approaching getting ready for sport, like it's, even it says in there, like everything affects everything. And you know, it can be cliche and like, yes, there are things that, you know, don't necessarily impact as much, but it's easy, it'd be very easy as a strength and conditioning staff to, you know, you decide on a few metrics that you want to track. Okay, their 3RM front squat and their pull-ups and their 10-yard start and their fly 10 and their broad jump. And you track those and you train and then you track them again and they all went up and you go, hey, look, we're good at our jobs. That's easy. And it's not to say that, you know, tracking metrics isn't valuable, but it's like as a strength staff, it'd be very easy to do that and say, okay, we're good to go. We did our jobs. But it, you know, we can impact so much on other things, and it helps you realize and get down to the bottom of like what the limiter to performance actually is. Because you can have a problem that's rearing its head, and like even like with the sprinting stuff, if you don't find the true root cause, you're never going to solve it. And so, like, even, you know, it is in that web, you know, it goes into like emotional control and, you know, anxiety control and those sorts of things, because, you know, maybe it, like, for instance, our like repeat sprintability work that we do in the summer, it's like we treat it as like game day. It's our third high day of the week. It's like alactic capacity, bridging on some lactate, depending on the weeks as we go. But it's like full speed, fast, repeat sprintability where we're tweaking the rest, where it's not enough rest so that it's still pretty shitty, but it's enough rest that you're still going fast, fast. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun, I should say. But, yeah. You know, we're videotaping it, like scoring it, everything. Like it's high, it's a high stress environment. And so you have some guys who are in amazing, just from a purely a physical standpoint, they're in a good spot. Like in the, you know, maybe our lower stress, like extensive tempo days, like they're smacking everything. They're hitting pretty shapes. Like they're smooth, just roll in, like they have no issues. And then you put them into that high stress environment and they get drugged. And it's easy to then look at that and say, he's out of shape. Like he can't hit it. Like he ain't got it. When in reality, he just can't handle the emotions of the moment. And so his heart rate's at 150, even before we start the warm up. So he's just freaking out. And it's like, so then, you know, understanding that everything goes into that helps you actually find the root cause, which then can make sure that, you know, the problems aren't persisting into the game, which is ultimately what we want. Because it's easy, you know, it's easy to just kind of write it off as something else that's maybe easily fixable. And you kind of attack that and you go, well, I tried to fix that other thing and it didn't work. So whatever. Whereas like really diving into what is affecting this truly is, you know, fun. I mean, and it
is.
Ultimately helps the outcomes be better, you know, whether it's a nagging soft tissue injury and you end up, you know, you find out that the nutrition is horrible, or, you know, whatever, it's a kid always showing up late to stuff, but then you find out he's having like major sleep issues, you know, things like that, you know, there's just hypotheticals or whatever, but it's like, and even if they're not even that extreme, like everything goes into everything. And I guess I tied into it a little bit with like the team speed system standpoint, where it's like in very complicated systems, which each individual within the team is a system in and of itself. And then the whole team is a system. So you have systems within systems. And it's like, you can't just change one individual thing and say, okay, this is going to cause this. Like, that's silly. You can't, like, oh, I, you know, this complex human being, you know, even in, like, the sprint examples we, I gave you, like, okay, it's one of our super muscly linebackers, and he's really, has a really tight rectus, and so he can't get into these, like, high heel recoveries that we want to see. Like, okay, we just get some mobility in the rectus and he's good to go. Like, even with that, it's never that simple. Like,
yeah,
that maybe because maybe that then causes him to not be as explosive when he's tackling. You know, like there's all sorts of things that go into that. And you're never going to have the right answer because there's no way to account for all the things that go into it, you know, unless you have like AI helping you out. But it's like you having at least coming at things from the perspective of, you know, okay, if I do this, we're changing this in anticipation of a positive outcome somewhere in the program. And then making sure to even within that conversation to say, okay, where is it going to probably have a negative effect? Where is it gonna not necessarily have positive or negative, but some sort of change, like, cause it's going to change something else somewhere. It's on you to start to find that. And, you know, whether it's simple as, hey, we're going to crank up our speed volume as we were working throughout the summer, like, okay, like our weight room volume probably needs to come down a little bit, like things as simple as that, but then also as, you know, often overlooked as like, hey, we're having to, you know, spike the technical load by having fall camp start, and then the tactical load is spiking as well. Or I just repeat that the technical and tactical load is getting a super spike at the start of camp. Like, hey, like, could we maybe introduce the tactical a little earlier, a few weeks earlier with some meetings so that those spikes aren't at the same time? Like those sorts of things that go into it. And I like Fergus Connolly's coactive model that helps like account just like looking at it from that aspect, like, okay, like, you know, with football specifically, we go through the summer, and that's one of the reasons we're so adamant about like keeping our like player led practices and integrating those so that we're, you know, and then teaching guys about, you know, emotional control and all those, because it's like you have to be training all four of those in some capacity year round, and so that none of them ends up getting super spiked at one point. You know, like for instance, you know, we're doing a lot, like the summer is a lot of physical in football, but along the way, we're doing a lot of teaching in terms of emotional and putting them in situations where they have to control that. And, you know, whether it's through education or experiences and right in the moment and, you know, understanding what, you know, how to control positive self-talk and like things like that on that aspect. But then also going into like from a technical standpoint, like they have their player-led practices where they're getting those specific drills throughout the summer, and then even the tactical part, like if we can fit in some, you know, within the NCAA rules, we give a little bit of our strength and conditioning time away so that they can fit in a couple meetings, so that they can install a couple things. You know, we do that throughout the year so that all those things are kind of working together year round. And then obviously there those different jugs are getting filled up at different times, but the water that's filling the jugs is all coming from the same source. So just being aware of that instead of being like, okay, it's the summer, we're going to train our asses off and that's all we're worrying about, and then you get to fall camp and all of a sudden these true freshmen are having to learn the playbook and the drills that they want to do, and like, and it's just like, what's happening? Like, and so making sure that those, all four of those are being accounted for year round. And even if it's at a time when one of them isn't necessarily being trained, we're at least accounting for like, okay, we're not training this and that's intentional.
Yeah.
But being aware of how those work together all the time is huge, and it ensures that your outcomes are going to be positive, or ensures that your outcomes are going to be more positive than if you didn't do that, I should say.
Yeah. I think that's a big consideration, is like, what is the potential negative outcome of these things? So we focus so much on the positives, but that is an extra step you have to take, and it is more work, but ultimately for the reasons that you stated, it's going to be much more beneficial down the road if you can like take that. It does require some degree of ego checking too, because there might be something you really want to do as a coach then it's going to actually negatively affect an outcome that you potentially weren't foreseeing if you had not done that thought process. Well, Joel, I appreciate you coming on, man. And where can people find you on social media?
On Twitter, it's at Joel Reinhart. On Instagram, I think it's Joel H. Reinhart. And then my email is jreinhart@umass.edu. And then website is sprintjumpthrow.com. And that's linked on all my social media if you want to find that. But yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I enjoyed hearing your thoughts on this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right.